remarks first, because I think it sets up the tone for this evening's conversation. And if you think about the journey that we've traveled this week, where, as I said in the beginning, we're really just scratching the surface of a whole range of fascinating, curiosity-driven issues. We started the week with Prof. Ndebele asking, where are you from? In this question of who are we, shifting identities in post-apartheid South Africa. And Dr. Rink asked the next evening, where do you belong? And Dr. Zuma asked, what are we? You know, are we human or not? And last night, Dr. Norman asked us, who is a real man in the constructions of masculinity around issues of sexual violence? So we have spoken about the masks that we wear. We have spoken about the many different masks that we wear and how they change in different situations. We've spoken about the way that our environments shape us and the way that we engage with our environments. We've spoken about the way that we cannot be reduced to one single label, so we can't talk about a person is just right or just a man or just girl. We've spoken about how our identities shift. We've spoken about race, we've spoken about sexuality, we've spoken about masculinities, we've heard these great words, heteronormativity and hegemonic masculinities. We have considered human and spoken about humanity. We've spoken about visibility and whether people are seen or not. We've spoken very little about class and poverty, although I think it's been a thread that has gone through a lot of the different discussions. So we've been traversing very vast territories in terms of subject matter. Prof. Ndebele asked us on Monday evening to lean in to the conversations that we need to have as a society. And I saw a lot of familiar faces in Prof. Jansen and Prof. Sudeen's talk about transforming higher education this afternoon. And I think it was a very similar conversation. And I'm glad to see that there are people who are crossing the topics. And really, that leaning in is about the kind of space that we want to create. And what work and thinking that it will take, as Bhutia asked us on Wednesday, what it will take for us to be free. And I don't think that we can do this without considering ourselves part of this continent, which is one of the reasons why I asked Professor Kwakwa to be here this evening. And adding, in addition to this huge array of things that we've already spoken about, some more very huge topics, issues of culture, of language, of development, adding these to the mix. And this is really what Professor Chris Kwakwa is going to do with us this evening. So he's going to expand our view beyond our borders, and I'm not just talking about our geographical borders, but perhaps our mental borders as well. And if I can take the privilege of introducing him to you, Prof. Kwakwa is the director of the Center for Advanced Study of African Society, which is based in Rondebosch. He has a long and illustrious academic career that spans continents and countries, and has held positions in Uganda, West Germany, Ghana, Botswana, China, the UK, Sudan, Lesotho, Kenya, Namibia, and ended up at the University of the Western Cape as a professor there before starting his directorship at CASAS. And their mission at CASAS, which I think is a very vital mission, is to undertake fundamental research on African society and disseminate that research through publications that are made widely available to people. So having said that, I'm going to pass over to Professor Kwakwa, who is going to take you on a little journey of his own.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. As Mrs. Orugundade said, I'm going to try and take you on a journey, because the narrative I'm going to offer you cannot be dissociated with my own search for answers. In other words, the subject and the object are not completely separate. The what I'm going to discuss with you this evening is largely also part of my own life and the attempt to grapple with answers, large answers and small answers, large questions and small questions relating to the condition of Africans in our times. I was fortunate enough to be...
There's some people who are not hearing you very well. Can we ask you to hold the...
I was fortunate enough to have seen the last stages of the colonial period of African history. And I saw the beginnings of the process which, after the Second World War, we saw all over the world, the colonial freedom, the process of the attainment of colonial freedom by lots of countries which belong to...
I can't hear.
Oh. Yes. The countries which belong to the Western empires in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. At the beginning of this period, most of the idea of development and advancement and progress for subject peoples was in the hands of bodies like the Colonial Development Fund in the UK and the French equivalent. The Portuguese treated the colonies as overseas territories. There was only one Spanish colonial enclave in Africa proper, I mean sub-Saharan Africa, that's Equatoria, which has become Equatorial Guinea. And we saw the idea of progress, development, transformation, in this period, rationalized largely in terms of what has come to be known as modernization theories. Now, these theories generally were American products of American intellect, sponsored in the beginning by the US government, largely funding much of it. And it spawned a whole group of academics working on Africa and African development, academics like Gwendolyn Carter, the Rosbergs, lots of people. The British who were involved in this process were assets, were leftovers from the earlier period when I'm thinking of people like Marjorie Perham. They were left over from the other period. But the Americans very quickly transformed the field and expanded the expertise that existed on Africa and the challenges of development. That was in the early to late 50s. By the time Ghana attained its independence and close to the end of that decade, we entered the 60s. The 60s were the decade of African independence. Two-thirds of African states emerged in that period. And the modernization theories, which saw modernization as mainly adoption of Western patterns and Western axioms of development, prevailed for a long time. By the time people like me got into studying this phenomenon in the 60s in the West, in Western Europe, the atmosphere had changed, the intellectual atmosphere in the West had changed. And if you recall, because I see that quite a few of you are fairly senior in age, so you may be able to remember this, but the 60s were a period of great ferment and challenge to authority and power, and libertarian ideas were flourishing in Europe and so on, and people were challenging the governments, the authoritarian governments of Eastern Europe and so on. And left-wing ideas became very much in vogue, particularly varieties of watered-down Marxian approaches which were sponsored largely by Latin American academics like Dos Santos and African academics like Samir Amin and others. Now, they were all looking for answers to the challenge of development. The modernization theorists were abandoned. The neo-Marxists became ascendant, and the ideas of center and periphery emerged. That carried on for also quite a while. But then these ideas were outflanked, superseded by, I think, largely French ideas of which came in from elsewhere, which came in from philosophy and linguistics, but which entered the larger field of human transformation and change, structuralism. And so not too long after that, that was assailed by others in the name of post-structuralism. These were the French thinkers. They also tried to influence our thinking on how to change society, how to transform society, how the Third World, as it then was popularly called, Africa, Asia, Latin America, could be transformed into a developing area of the world. Now, that also hardly happened. There was a profusion of these theories and endless debates, but nothing really substantial in terms of the theories being valid and credible points of departure for implementation of ideas and the transformation of society on the ground didn't happen. So we went off in other directions. And some of us stayed put with some of the older ideas, but largely people moved on, and very soon were in the hands of the big institutions of the world, like the Bretton Woods organizations, the World Bank, the IMF, and the rest of them. Now, we have not seen Africa change. In fact, there are many who argue that in terms of the quality of life, there has been stagnation or retrogression in many places in Africa, and that what we have to show does not really warrant any praise for us. I think this is largely true, because if you look at where we've come from and where we're supposed to be going, 50 years and the record isn't very much. Doesn't show very much. Now, the problem was not only at the theoretical level of very economistic technicist approaches to the challenges of development. No. The problem we soon realized was in another area, the area of culture. Now, culture writ large, I mean, I don't mean culture in a very restricted, museum-focused sense, but culture as everything that has been produced by humans, in which and with which we live, which we create continuously on a daily basis, and which also creates us, like a two-way process. We create culture, but culture creates us. Humans are just cultural animals, and in fact, it's in that sense that we differ sharply from animals. The main difference between us and animals is that we create culture, and animals do not create culture substantively. But if this is culture, if culture is everything we create and do and live in, how does this happen? How does this go on? Well, no culture is sealed. No culture is closed off from other cultures. All cultures, to some level, when they're face to face, interpenetrate and carry on processes of mixing and blurring and adopting and rejecting. Selection processes go on all the time with between cultures. And so that's a ceaseless feature of culture. Now, areas of culture too can be said to, in my estimation, move into what is unidentifiable to one source anymore. They become universal qualities. There are cultural features which are universal wherever you go. And this is happening all the time. The terrain of universal culture keeps increasing. But at the same time, there are specificities and peculiarities of societies and cultures and histories of people which continue and linger and on. So that's broadly culture. It includes everything. But basically, two features of culture, two major features of culture. Elements which are tangible, which you can see, which you can feel, which you can touch. And other elements which are totally intangible. So, the table, the chair, glass, everything is part of culture. Clothes we wear, everything is a part of culture, and it's tangible. But there are intangibles, like the language we speak, like religion, like values, etc. Beliefs, mythology, that sort of thing. That's also part of culture. But the most important feature of culture is language. And it's language which carries everything. Language is some sort of a register. In a language, you can read the history of a people. Language constantly, and everything which is created is imported directly, it's transacted in language. Language, therefore, is a huge compendium of everything that we know, or everything that is, in other words, also knowable. As soon as we have it in language, it becomes part of our reality, becomes part of our real world. The Austrian philosopher Wittgenstein says, the language you know is the extent of our world. I say, no, language even goes beyond that. Language also, in a sense, is a window onto culture. Once you get into a language, you get into a cultural world of the constituency which uses the language. And the more languages you know, the more doors you can open into cultures. Into different cultures, different histories, different peoples, different origins, different makings, you can access that. Language also is the fabricator. In other words, language is a technique, it's a technology tool, because it helps us to live, to operate in nature. And it is not only also a technology, it is an instrument for assessing the difference between us and our environment, the difference between us and our attempts to manipulate our environment. Language permits all of this. But this is what language does, and we all speak language in either one or the other form, either as a literate language or purely oral language. Languages all start historically as oral forms, but they become literate. And in fact, there has since also the 60s been a whole debate about the relevance of language to civilization and development. In fact, the biggest aspect of this debate is those who insist that that there is a great divide between literacy and orality, or illiteracy, and it's the difference between civilization and barbarism. Ultimately, that without writing language, and language, written language started as measurements of things. Now, without language, it is impossible for societies to move beyond, without language as a written form, it's impossible for societies to move beyond a given limited scope of development. I think there is great truth in that. Then when we relate all of this to the African condition, what does it say? In Africa, we have a host of languages, but not quite as many as people suggest. In fact, the work I've done shows that differentiation, the morphological and phonological differentiation between African languages, is not more than you can find anywhere else in the world. The difference is that the labeling of what is a language, the criteria for labeling and how languages are labeled, varies from place to place. If you went to the Netherlands, If you label a friend of mine, an anthropologist, a Dutch anthropologist, told me, we say, yes, I think it's very important, this work you're doing, because if we were labeling our languages, if we were labeling what we speak in Holland, the way you people label yours in Africa, we would have 20 languages in the Netherlands. You see, the Gronings will come. Language Rotterdam, Amsterdam, Limburg, Brabant, all of this become different languages, because morphologically and phonologically there are distinctive characteristics peculiar to each of these speech forms. Now, you can elevate this by writing them differently, by giving different symbols to the same sound or related sounds, and you end up on paper with a different language. You see? And so the labeling dimension of language is very important. And there are always forces behind this labeling process, forces which are not scientific, linguistic, or rational, but which are political, often political, based on expediency of political groups, and so on, vying for influence and power, and the labeling of these speech forms into different categories, even when they are closely related, in fact, or very proximate cognate languages, which in fact are the same language, but you can say different dialectal forms. So that, for example, let me give you a example in South Africa. The difference between the so-called Northern Sotho and Southern Sotho is purely arbitrary. Pedi, Sotho, Tswana, it's no different. Seswati in Swaziland, Zulu, Kangwane, Xhosa, Ndebele are not hugely different. They are no more different than Tyneside is different from Cockney. Practically it's the same, but I mean, if you write, you can write them in such a way that they are different languages, and you can write them in such a way that they are the same language but slightly different lexically. You know, for example, if you go to Lesotho, the rules of spelling of Sesotho there is different from Bloemfontein, which is only 20 minutes flight. But it appears on paper as two different languages. And the people want to keep them as two different languages for political reasons, purely political, not rational, not scientific reasons, but purely rational. But it has an effect on the economic rationality of the use of a language. If you have a language which can be used by 5 million, 50 million people, it is of course much more viable than a language which is spoken only by 100,000 people. And if you have large languages with different variants, dialectal variants, then it makes sense to pull them together in a written form where everybody who speaks any of the varieties in the cluster is able to speak like he or she always speaks, but write it with the same rules of spelling as anybody else writing any of the languages in the cluster. This is what, for example, English does, and French and German. This is what Luther achieved for German. This is what Mao Zedong and his hordes achieved in the 20s for Mandarin Chinese. The rules of spelling that unify languages which are close lexically, if the languages are about 80%, 85% the same, they are not really different languages. I mean, otherwise English and American will be different. Again, there you see now they insist on spelling differently with some words, but it's only political, just to maintain the sense of identity of difference. But English say L-A-B-O-U-R for labor, Americans say B-O-R for labor. Now, it doesn't make any sense in keeping two different spellings for a language which is 90% the same lexically, but for purposes of distinction, maintaining a difference in identity, they prefer to keep it like that. Now, right across Africa, you have the same phenomenon. You see, in Africa, UNESCO, for example, suggests that there are anywhere between 1,500 and 200,000, 2,000 languages. And there is no hard and fast figure on the languages of Africa because of the labels we put on them. And there are some people in the business who want to discover new languages in Africa, who insist that their mission is to translate the Bible in as many languages as possible for humanity. And therefore have a mission, like they've always had in the 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, to go out into the rest of the world and discover new tribes and render the Bible in the language of a tribe. And they do this quite idiosyncratically, you know, that they know no authority. They create their own rules of spelling. So that in the end, you have a situation in which small linguistic variation is elevated to the status of serious distinction, and then on paper it becomes a different language, and it's taught and written that way, and it becomes a language. It becomes a language, as it were. So I found that 75 to 85% of African languages, if you put them in clusters based on mutual intelligibility, and related structural similarities, affinities, we will find that it is possible to group African languages into about 17 major clusters, which will take care of about 85% of all speech forms on the continent. The largest of these, in terms of geographical expanse and also demography, is a language called Pular in West Africa. Well, it starts from the Senegambia and Mauritania, and it goes all the way to the Sudan. And then southwards, it comes as far as the Central African Republic, spoken in 17 countries, Pular. It is called variously in different places, Tukler, Peul, Pula, Fula, Fulful, Fulfulde, Fulani, Felata, depending on where you are. And they all more or less understand each other. You know, they will miss some words, some of the lexicals may be different, but they will understand what they are about. The second biggest one is called Mandeng. It's also in West Africa, Mandingo, Malinke, Mandi, Jula, Kasonke, Bamanan. It's also a fairly big one, spoken in about 9 countries in West Africa. Then there are the giants of West Africa in limited areas like Yoruba in Nigeria, and Benin, Igbo in Nigeria, all spoken by at least 50 plus million, at least for mother tongue speakers, it's about 50. For people who know these languages as second or third languages, you can add another 20 million. So they are huge languages, languages as big as German. Now you will ask yourself, why is it that German can be written, is written, should be, is written, and Igbo or Ijo is not written? Does that have anything to do with the fact that the people are not making progress? Yes, this is what I'm saying. But until such time that you start developing the languages and putting them in use, you're not going to make any progress. Because no society on earth develops without the usage of the languages which the overwhelming majorities of the people use. Otherwise you can't lift them. If you use for development purposes languages which are only spoken by 10% of the population, it means you cut off from literacy, serious use of literacy, the majority of the population. You can ask, well, why don't you force everybody else to speak the languages of the 10%? Is that democratic? Will that work? What will be the result in 50 or 100 years from the start of that process? You'll find that the people have ceased to be what they were. I correspond with a Welshman, a Welsh nationalist called Sion Jobbins. And he sent me a book recently, within the last week, called The Phenomena of Welshness. And he's always decrying the fact that the language of his people, the Welsh, has been, well, near obliteration. It's near obliteration. They're trying hard to maintain it and so on, but it's suffering under the dominance of English. The Irish also try that. They're also working at it. But it's been work in progress forever and ever. Now, language is also the history of a people. Language is the identity of a people. If you destroy the language of a people, they become another people. Like what we've seen in North Africa since the 7th century, since the 8th century. That most of the people of North Africa have been Arabized, they speak Arabic. But they were not Arabic speakers before. Now they will go to war defending Arabism. They have become Arabs. That's ethnocide on the one hand, but on the other hand it's called Arabization. If you change somebody's language and you give him another language and he abandons his customs and his beliefs and mythologies, he becomes somebody else automatically. The question also, the big question is it possible for people to develop on the basis of a borrowed language? It doesn't work anywhere. If you look again in the past 50 years, in the societies of Asia, like Vietnam, Cambodia, Indonesia was a Dutch colony for hundreds of years. Vietnam was a French colony. Cambodia was a French colony, but they don't use French anymore. And I say that is why they're making so much progress. Vietnam is the fastest growing economy in Asia because you're using for their development languages which reach the man in the village and which the man in the village can understand. All the technologies of the world can be rendered in this language. So I think, and this is the distinct difference between the societies, the post-colonial societies of Africa and those of Asia, that in 1969 when I went to India, I was pleasantly surprised to find all the regional languages were languages of science and technology up to university level. But if you go to Kerala, they speak Malayalam. Next door there is Tamil Nadu, and so on and so forth. When I went to China in 1980, I went to Mongolia, and I went to the university there. And they took me to the language laboratory. They said, well, look, our language until 1949-50 was not written properly. Now we can study anything in Mongolian. And you can go to university here studying in Mongolian. Now, this, in my estimation, is responsible. This factor is responsible for the recession, the cultural, educational, technological recession we face in Africa. That we are trying to move forward on very narrowly based languages. In where I come from, in Ghana, the percentage of people who speak English and write English with any degree of adeptness is no more than 10%, 10-15% of the population. Now you ask yourself, how can they compete? Can they creatively compete with the British? I can't compete with Shakespeare in his language. It's ridiculous to expect that to happen. But then when you say this, people ask, but then what are you suggesting? You're suggesting that everybody must speak an African language? No. The question is, the issue is that everybody must have basically the right to use a language which he or she knows from home, close to his heart, you see. And it's possible, like the Swiss do. Switzerland is a small country. It's no bigger than one of the provinces of South Africa. But there's multiculturalism and linguistic tolerance. You can study anything in German, Italian, Romansh, French. And so they go on. In Belgium, there are two sections. There are the Flemish and the French. And it's a small country. In Canada, they have two languages. It is possible, if there is the will, and if people see the value of it, understand the value of it, to have a dispensation which allows a number of languages to be developed so that everybody can be lifted up. It's not difficult to speak four or five languages. Most Swiss can speak four languages. And I don't think it's only because when I went to school in the Netherlands, I was surprised when I got into the university to find that lecturers will ask you on the reading list, you find 25 books, you're supposed to read 5 of them. Some of the books will be in German, some in French, some in Dutch, some in English. And it was assumed that everybody in the university had working knowledge of these languages. Everybody could read these languages and understand these languages and work in these languages. It is only simply because in the educational system, at the earlier stages, they expose kids to these languages. There's no magic about it. Dutch are not better polyglots than anybody else. You know, but if you build it into the educational system well at an early stage, then it's very easy for children to learn languages like that. You see? So what we realize is that if we do that in Africa, if we harmonize the spelling systems of African languages, we use these languages and we use also the colonial languages, it should be possible to create huge economically viable constituencies for languages. If you write in Ndebele, Zulu, Xhosa, Seswati, Chingoni, Chinsenga, in the lakeshore of Malawi, if you write them with the same rules of spelling, then suddenly you have a market of 70 million in each instance. Sotho, Tswana, Nguni, you have Fulani, then you have Kiswahili, then you have the low languages, and it's economically viable. And you can even have universities which use these languages. Then you will have development. I'll stop here because I see.
Thank you very much, Professor.
You have reminded me of two sayings. The first is a West African saying, until the lion has its own historian, the history of the hunt will always glorify the hunter. And I think it's a very apt saying. It really means that the people who have power to tell the story is the story that prevails. And we live in a society where we're trying to change those stories, or at least find alternative stories to the stories that have been told. And you've added another dimension, which is that it should be in a language that is understood by the majority of the people. And the other saying is Audre Lorde's saying of, we will never dismantle the master's house with the master's tools. So having said those two things, which you really made me think of as you were speaking, I'd like to throw the floor open for questions or comments.
One of the problems that we have in terms of multilingual societies and education, for instance, in South Africa, where we have 11 official languages, and so people learn in their own languages and study English as a second or third language. So you have students who study all their lives in Afrikaans, or in Zulu, or in any of the other languages, coming here into this university where knowledge is passed, you know, the readings, the essays you write, the language of instruction is in English. So you find a lot of people who are not, where I come from, how well you speak English is how we judge your intelligence. You know, say, oh, this guy's dumb, he can't speak English. And he says he's educated. So you have people who are essentially intelligent, they are good in school, but they cannot communicate in English. So they write essays that make no sense, they keep quiet in class because they think they cannot speak English. And then it becomes a problem that people who have a business fail. While if they are studying in English all their lives, like I have done, and I agree with you, I can't compete with an English person in their language. You know, I'm only, my dad says that you are finished the day you start thinking in another language. Fortunately, I think in English, rather than Yoruba. And so, you know, how do we navigate around these issues where, you know, we say, oh, it's good for people to get knowledge in their own language, but we don't have universities that speak their language, they have to come. And then they start failing only because they do not speak that language or because they are dumb. How do we do this? How do we, you know?
Take another question. So I like that you're alluding to people creating culture and culture creating people. And in the context of language and development, I went to a Portuguese class once, and someone in my class spoke of how they'd written in Mozambique, and they would tell each other the struggle continues. That was like their hello. Yeah, that was how they would say it to each other. But my question, or something that got me thinking, was how does the language or the context in which we use language actually hinder or create development in terms of societal development? So like how language affects the way we progress as a nation. I'm quite...
One more question, and then I think we'll go to
the I was wondering whether you could comment on, in the time of Julius Nyerere in Tanzania, all education was said to take place in Swahili, right through to university level. I believe this has been discontinued. Can you just comment on that?
Yes. I think the issue you raise is really an issue of policy. It's an issue of policy. You see, remember I said if we are serious, if we realize that people should be empowered with their own lives, and we are serious, we will make the money for it. And the dividends may not show immediately for the whole society in 10 years, but in 15 years it will show dramatically. You know, it is possible to have a policy which ensures that by the time a kid gets into university anywhere in Africa, he or she knows five languages, can read and write five languages, to different degrees of accomplishment, but able to work in these languages. It's nothing strange. Why should a Dutch man or a Danish kid be able to do that and not here? You know, why should a Dane or a Dutchman do it and not an Englishman? There's nothing strange about it. It's just a question of policy and following through policies which allow us. That's all there is to it. Yeah. Now, the idea of progress, collective progress, yes. We make progress, but progress is not just this building. Progress is also being able to understand this building, the construction of this building, in your language. You see, that you don't have to learn Russian or German or English or French to understand how to construct a language like this, but that you can construct in your own language. The technology for it can be rendered in your own language. Then you lift everybody up. And it doesn't mean that you should learn only your own language, no. You learn many languages, and then you carry on. You can move across the society from one language group to the other easily. Now, the last point was about Kiswahili and what happened with Kiswahili. Well, unfortunately, they didn't follow through seriously.
Why not?
That's a good question. It's because of us, the elites. It's because of the African elites. The African elites owe their cultural power to the use of the colonial language. It's like a bird on a branch. You tell the bird to cut the branch on which it's standing. You know, I mean, there are parliaments in Africa where you can't enter if you do not speak a colonial language. So it means 90% of the people are excluded. Now, Kiswahili, they made a pronouncement, but they didn't back it up with the resources. They made no attempt to do that. I remember in Namibia, I remember at the time of independence, I was there. We were setting up the new university, transforming the old academy into a university. And the Minister of Education then, whilst he was designing a program based on mother tongue for the early years for his children, he was sending his children to an all English medium school. So it's the elite, it's us, those who are variously in power. I'm not talking with just politicians, but the whole elite who are responsible for this. I think, of course, the continuance of this policy is because of us. We are keeping this thing going. The Asian elites have gone beyond that. As I said, look at Indonesia. In 1948, when they broke off, they were already using Bahasa. Bahasa is also widely used in Malaysia. Malaysia got its independence in 57. But it makes a difference because, you see, you bring knowledge and everything fresh, everything new, everything universal in the language of a man on the ground, a man in the village. And you can lift them up that way. What you describe is also in Madagascar. You know, there the problem is even more tragic, because in Madagascar they have only one language, Malagash, spoken by everybody. At some point, they decided to use Malagash, but they didn't put resources behind it. And very soon the French came, and the French said, look, we will give you French books. So back again, they went to the bosom of a colonial power, you see, and they haven't made progress since then. So it's right across Africa, not so much in Asia, and I say this is why Asia is moving forward and Africa is going nowhere. And if it goes on like this in Africa, in another 100 years, we will cease to be Africans. We will become Englishmen and Portuguese and Arabs. French, no.
Sorry. How would you suggest that all the money, the economic resources required, to translate the vast body of literature which is available, notably in English, into all of the languages you could code?
Well, it's not so big. Remember, I'm saying that Malaysia was a British colony. And the variation of languages on the ground, it's no different. If we want to do it, it's possible to do it. You know, it's possible. The European Union, it consists of over 25, 27 different languages. When they meet, they have translators for all these languages. They study in all these languages. It's possible to do it. I think it's money better spent on this than on guns and gunboats and aircraft, fancy aircraft, and so on.
Last, sorry, I'm sorry about, but if we can give somebody else the last comment.
Sorry, thank you so much. I found this really interesting, but I have to wonder if we're not maybe moving towards a global community. I mean, technology has brought everyone so much closer. I mean, you can start up a business in Durban and your business partner can live in Malaysia or Australia. And I wonder, as much as there's value to culture and language, I wonder if maybe the future of the world is that it will have one culture, that it will start to be amalgamated. And then is there value in investing in something like this as opposed to investing in languages that you know that you'll be able to do business in Portuguese, in Spanish, and Chinese and English. And I don't want us to lose our culture, but I wonder if maybe that's the way that the world is going.
That's a good question, which you often hear. In the first instance, I think the world would be a much poorer place if we all have one culture. What's the word? Terrible. No. Apart from that, you see, the advantage of modern science and technology is also that we can render translations in seconds. You know? And I'm not saying that everybody must speak one language. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that everybody must speak more than 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 languages. I can. Why can't you? It's not because I have any inclination or disposition to languages. No. Just it was thrown in my way as I grew up somehow, you know. So it's possible to. Why does a Dutchman speak 4 or 5 languages? I have a friend, Dutchman, who speaks 12 languages. You know, and each language you know opens the door for you to learn another language. The next language becomes easier. There's nothing difficult about it. And I think the world would be a better place. The process of railroading everybody into one or two languages is a process which will be fraught with wars and conflict unnecessarily. You know, the process of letting 100 flowers bloom and people coexisting culturally in a multicultural world is a better, that's what the United Nations in the last two decades is pushing also. This is the position of UNESCO, that we must allow multiculturalism, that people should be able to celebrate their cultures, not one culture dominating other cultures, not one people. Because if a culture dominates others, then the people dominate. That's what it is, and it doesn't make for a good world, a peaceful world, a rich world, a variegated with tapestry of peoples. No, this is what we've inherited, a world of peoples, you know, and we must make it work for our collective benefit. One more?
I think we've reached time, unfortunately. I just really want to say thank you again to all of you for being here this week, to Prof for closing the session with such provocative and sense-making presentation. And I think to bring it closer to home to us is a question about, you know, how many languages do we speak of those that exist in this country? And if we don't speak more than two, why is that? I think that says something about the elite structures and the power and how it functions in the society as well. Having said that last Solberg's comment, two pieces of administration. One is that if you didn't get a copy of Prof's paper, there might still be some copies on the way out the door. And lastly, we would really very much, Summer School as a whole, appreciate the feedback on the evaluation forms that were handed to you as you came in the door. There are boxes spotted around the place, so please take a chance to fill that in and hand it in. And lastly, the invitation from one of the members of this discussion over the last couple of days, just a reminder that if you'd like to meet in the Baxter after the session, that there might be a space for you to connect and have a conversation afterwards. Thank you so much, Prof. Thank you for your time and your input and your thinking and your energy and the journey that you've taken us on. Thanks to all of the speakers in their absence, and thanks to all of you for being here. I really appreciate it.